Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Cuba will not have a place at the 35-nation Summit of the Americas that starts tomorrow in Trinidad and Tobago with President Obama in attendance. But the American embargo on the island nation and pressure on the U.S. to end it will. Cuban Americans will be watching closely. This hour On Point, weighing diplomacy with Cuba and what the future may hold for Cubans and Cuban Americans. You can join our conversation. Cuban Americans, what's your reaction to President Obama lifting restrictions on travel and remittances to Cuba? Do you welcome the development or worry that the U.S. is giving up leverage? Joining me now first is Mark Silva, Washington correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, and other Tribune newspapers. He was senior political writer for the Miami Herald for 21 years, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Mark Silva, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you.
President Obama arrives in Mexico City today. He's on his way to Trinidad and Tobago, as I mentioned, for the Summit of the Americas. News about Cuba seems front and center. Explain to us, Mark, the lifting of these travel and remittance restrictions towards Cuba. What exactly does that entail?
Well, it applies to Cuban Americans who have relatives in Cuba, and specifically to, I think, 3 degrees of relation, cousins and the like. And it lifts what has for a long time been a very tight restriction on the ability of Cuban Americans to travel to visit relatives. They've been limited to every two or three years. They've been limited in what they can bring and send to their relatives, the money and gifts. And now the travel restrictions and the gift restrictions, the remittances, is all being lifted to open up travel to the island for relatives. The U.S. also is allowing cell phone companies to license and provide cell phone service and allow Americans to support cell phones for their relatives in Cuba, all as a means of opening up communications.
Is Obama's decision a significant departure from past administrations?
Well, it's a sharp departure on the question of travel and gifts. The previous administration was very strict about this, and the U.S. government has been for a long time. So it's a sharp departure on the relations that Cuban Americans have with their relatives on the island. However, there's still one major piece of U.S. policy that has not been changed, and that's the overall U.S. trade embargo with Cuba.
How does the rest of the hemisphere view the U.S. embargo against Cuba?
They don't like it. They view it as an anomaly. The rest of the hemisphere is trading with Cuba. In fact, people who want to subvert the embargo have gone through Mexico City or other ports of entry to Havana. And the rest of the hemisphere thinks it's punitive and irrelevant and is calling on the United States to put it away.
And so how much pressure with that call will there be at this Summit of the Americas in Trinidad for President Obama to actually do that?
I suspect the president will hear a lot about that because, in effect, what the U.S. policy means now is that Americans, Cuban Americans, are open to travel to Cuba, but it really has no bearing on the greater trade picture. And so there are trading partners in South America, and particularly Venezuela, which whose leader has been so critical and outspoken of the United States. He's a strong ally and politically aligned with the Castro regime. If there's going to be any kind of sort of rapprochement, with the U.S. and the region, they're really going to press this embargo issue, I suspect. Mm.
Cuba was not invited to the summit in Trinidad. Is Cuba?
The White House has made a point of noting that only democratically elected presidents will be invited. So Cuba is not a party.
And so is the absence of Cuba further evidence of its alienation from the rest of Latin America?
Well, it is, because, there is still this sense that there's still this old, really Cold War mentality, which goes beyond Cuban-American relations and has to do with the seeding of this, communist regime, which is still, holding political prisoners after all these years.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite an anomaly in modern foreign relations.
And yet Castro and the regime has strong support from places, as you mentioned, Venezuela, China, Iran. How does that other support alter our potential relationship, if at all?
Well, it adds pressure. And, President Obama actually has said that He views these concessions that he's making as a means of opening communications, of promoting a freer Cuba. He calls the Cuban-American people and their relatives, you know, the greatest ambassadors between the two nations. And he actually said in an interview on his way to Mexico City this week that they're going to be looking for how Cuba operates and to see if there's some sense of movement. And if so, Cuba can expect, quote, a further thawing of relations and further changes. Mm.
Mark Silva is Washington correspondent for the Tribune newspaper. He joins me from Washington, D.C. Mark, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Joining me now from Miami is Miriam Marquez, Metro columnist for the Miami Herald newspaper, where she has overseen award-winning reporting on the evolving face of Miami's Cuban exile community. She spent 18 years at the Orlando Sentinel and returned to her native Cuba for that newspaper in 2002. Miriam Marquez, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
What is your reaction to President Obama easing restrictions on travel and money being sent back to Cuba?
Well, I am cautiously optimistic as one who was born there and who still has cousins there and who was locked out the last 3 years from being able to help them directly without breaking U.S. law. This is a welcome change for me. At the same time, I am concerned about total lifting. I thought that we might be going back to the Clinton years where it was one trip a year, mm-hmm. and where there was a cap on the amount of money you could send. And the thinking back then was if you oversent beyond that amount of money, it would essentially go to the regime because it's things that people buy in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be the trick, whether this opening really starts to motivate people on the island, which we're already seeing among the young people there, that there is some of that. There's the Generation Y blog, which is immensely popular by Yoani Sanchez, and you can, she just lays it out there what's really happening in her country. She's been awarded by the European, she's received prestigious European awards for it. So I think, you know, that there's definitely an opening that's occurring within the younger generation as this older gerontocracy, which is what Cuba has under Raul Castro and who he's put in place, takes over.
There's a generational difference in the feeling about this. What are you hearing more broadly in Miami and then back in Cuba?
I think, in Miami, I would say it is the most pained place in America because so many of the exiles have family or friends who were imprisoned in Cuba at one time or another. And so they have a very direct and visceral feeling about it, and it's hard not to understand it if you were in the same type of situation. But beyond that, there's a whole younger generation thinking a little differently. It doesn't mean that they're sold on complete opening or lifting the embargo. I think it's a nuanced kind of position because you're seeing, if you look back just at these recent elections, you know, Obama won Miami-Dade County, but the three Republican Cuban-American members of Congress also won their districts.
So obviously there are some folks who want to protect the Cuba policy as it stands.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, because they deem it, it really, human rights is part bar none. And so they're looking at it from very much not a pragmatic point of view necessarily, but one of honor and one of dignity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where where it gets difficult.
Have you returned, Miriam, to Cuba since leaving as a little girl?
I returned in 2002.
And can you describe the conditions there when you were there?
At the time, it was before the big crackdown. There were 75 dissidents who were imprisoned in 2003. So I went a few months before that. It was as the Varela Project was taking place, which was Osvaldo Paya, one of the dissidents in Cuba, who is a Catholic and very much tied to the church, was pushing through Cuba's very own constitution to have freedom of assembly and freedom of owning your own businesses and property rights. And so he gathered the 10,000 signatures. He gathered more than that, that the constitution required. And what that did, Jimmy Carter went and talked about it and was put on Cuba TV. Immediately after that, Fidel Castro put together a massive march. And essentially in Cuba, when you have these massive marches, it's all your workplaces you're required to go. And there were more than a million people marching on Havana. And, you know, they immediately passed a law that said, no, never mind about, you know, any, there is no way to move outside of our constitution. So I think that's, when you put all the history in place, that's what's troubling, because whenever there is a move from the U.S. to open, you definitely see some greater opening in Cuba until the Castro regime starts to freak. And then, boom, you know, they cut back on whether it's little markets, you know, the farmers' markets, whether it's having paladares, people owning their own, you know, not owning, but running their little restaurants from their homes. The limits and the restrictions increase, and they have since 2003.
Which has affected the poverty and the conditions generally for people sort of at the bottom level.
Yes, and people were desperate. And one thing that I did get from speaking to them there, a lot of the younger people were ready to leave. They didn't see a solution that they could be a part of. And I think one of the things that I'm personally hoping this will do is that this movement of more Cuban Americans into Cuba to see their families is to encourage them to take positions that are within, you know, not to put themselves in danger, but certainly to start demanding the rights that supposedly Cuba's constitution is, you know, defends, which it doesn't.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're considering a new future in Cuba and for Cuban Americans this hour. Miriam Marquez is with us from Miami. She was born in Cuba and grew up in Miami. She's a Metro columnist for the Miami Herald newspaper, and she's covered the Cuban exile community in Florida for more than 25 years. Joining me now from Coral Gables, Florida, Jaime Sushlicki. He's director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami, has written 12 books on Cuba, including Cuba, From Columbus to Castro. Jaime Sushlicki, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
You just heard Miriam Marquez. What do you think about President Obama lifting restrictions on travel and remittances to Cuba? What's your take?
Well, I think that this is a logical move. People that have family in Cuba would like to visit. So this is a humanitarian. But beyond the restrictions on travel, the president has thrown also an olive branch to the Cuban government by offering them communication. The Cuban government falsely has complained over the years that the Cubans don't have access to the Internet because Cuba is not connected to fiber optics and is not connected to a lot of the new technology. So the U.S. government is telling the Cubans, okay, look, you open up, American companies will go there and will connect everybody to the Internet. This is not going to happen. The Cuban government is not going to allow this to happen. But, Jane, beyond the limited change that the president has introduced, the United States faces three or four options in Cuba. Option number one is do nothing and continue with the present policy. Option number two is lift the embargo and the travel ban unilateral without any concessions from the Cuban government. Third, sit down and negotiate with the Cuban government all of the pending issues in U.S.-Cuban relations. Or policy maybe fourth, begin to continue to offer little concessions in the hope that Cuba will respond.
But on a very basic level, sort of on the human level, what are the downsides for Cuban-American families who will now be able to reconnect with family in Cuba and even help them financially?
Absolutely, there's no downside, especially if they're willing to take literature, if they're willing to take magazines and things that Cubans cannot have access or not have access in Cuba and they can read. Sure, there's nothing. The only problem is that it's unlimited money going to Cuba. That I have somewhat of a problem. In part, the Cuban government charges 20% of every dollar that is sent from the United States. In an exchange rate, you have to pay 20 cents for every dollar, $20 for every 100. That is a big chunk of money that will come into the Cuban government without the Cuban government doing anything to help the Cuban people.
Here's another point about this from our website, from Renee, a listener who writes, when I ask about how a change in Cuba can be assisted by us here in the United States, almost everyone says increase interactions among countries. One person said, given a chance to rub shoulders with democracy, something will rub off.
What's your response to that, honey?
Okay, Jane, the Cubans have been rubbing elbows with the Canadians, the Europeans, the Spaniards for the past 2 decades. Millions of them have been to Cuba. There's no more democracy in Cuba. Tourism does not bring change. This is one of the fallacies that people have been saying. It has nothing to do with the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. Tourism peaked 10 years before communism collapsed. Communism collapsed for other reasons, the failure of communism, the changes in government in the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union involvement in Afghanistan and the failed war. So there are a number and the anti-Sovietism that existed in Eastern Europe. So there's nothing to empirically explain that tourism will have anything to do with that.
Miriam, let me get your perspective. Miriam in here because, Jaime, you write and you say here that why would we expect travel and tourism to open up, Iran and North Korea? Why would we expect it in Cuba? Miriam, what's your response to that?
Well, I tend to agree with him, and I come from, sort of this moderate position. But I really, tourism has an effect on those who work in the tourism sector. They are definitely in a better position than other workers because they get to get tips, which were outlawed and back and forth again. Another example of how the regime tries to control things when there's an opening. But and they get to talk to people. But here's the thing. They're scripted. To get that job, you essentially usually have what we call palanca, somebody in the Communist Party that's helpful to get you that job. They're screened. They get I'll get this great job, but I won't be able to do much, outside of what's expected of me. So I think that the notion as well that American tourists can come in and really affect a change when they're not really going to go to the just regular homes and see how people are living and breathing. They're going to be in the resorts. That's pretty much enclosed. They'll be taking the bus around for the tour of Centro Habana and see the little, market and the cathedrals. It is very, very limited
sterile.
And restricted.
It's not an authentic experience.
No.
Let me go to the phones to bring some listeners into this conversation. First from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl is on the line. Hi, Carl. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I think this is a great conversation to have. I believe that this is one of the more sillier foreign policies that the United States have had. It's been almost 50 years. It's a failed policy. It's hurting the Cuban people. It haven't hurt Fidel Castro. And I believe if President Obama wants to be a great president, like I think he do, some president is going to have to lift this embargo. It might as well be him. It might as well be now. I believe the timing could not be better. The United States and Cuba remind me of two old men that's mad at each other, two old brothers. They've been mad at each other for so long that they can't quite remember why they're mad at each other. They're just mad. And I believe it has to cease. And it's going to end one day. It might as well end today.
Thanks. Thanks for a good point, Jaime. I'll turn that to you.
Two points to answer this. Number one, no country gives away their policy. Every country wants something in return. In the case of Cuba, we want change, we want human rights, we want freedom and democracy for the island. Second, American foreign policy since the Carter era has emphasized that policy, human rights, freedom, democracy in Latin America. Not in the rest of the world, but at least in Latin America. We've intervened in Panama, we've intervened in Grenada, we've intervened in Haiti under President Clinton twice to restore democracy to those countries. Now, are we to send a message to the rest of Latin America that we are willing to lift the embargo and be friendly with a dictatorship in Havana without any concessions?
What about this point that the embargo is a Cold War relic, and Carl speaks to this, that it inhibits cooperation and feeds the anti-Americanism throughout the region, not just in Cuba? Miriam Marquez, time to end it?
Here's the thing with the embargo. We can look at it through the prism of nothing really has changed. And we can look at it, ever since we've had it and Cuba opened up and allowed Europe to come in and, partner for hotels and allowed Canadian tourists and everything else, They've been limited because they lost the Soviet Union, their sugar daddy, to what they can do anymore in the world as far as Angola, Ethiopia, all the places, Nicaragua, all the places where they were a prominent figure in helping to stir up revolution in ways that were very, very negative. And each time that this happened was a time when there was a closeness coming with U.S. policy. In other words, during the Clinton years, during Ford's short administration, as they were working toward, you know, looking at ending mm-hmm. the embargo mm-hmm. or at least relaxing it. So it has had an effect on Cuba's regime as far as tightening their ability to continue to spread what they consider to be the right thing, which we consider to be the wrong thing. It's basic when you look at it's 50 years with the same 11 presidents now have gone through the U.S. and we still have one family controlling Cuba. And I think that if Americans don't get that, I don't know what else. Now, we do trade with China. We do trade with Vietnam, where we lost more than 50,000 people. So obviously, U.S. policy is, it's like,
well, that's a good
spotty
point. Jaime, Castro isn't exactly isolated. I mean, Cuba has international support. China, Venezuela, Iran, does that support worry you?
Well, sure, it worries me. China has an electronic eavesdropping station near Havana that listens to American communications and steals American commercial secrets from companies like IBM, Microsoft, and others. And Castro sends it to other countries or sells that information. So, yes, there is a concern. There's a concern that Russian ships have visited Cuba. There is a concern that the Russians are putting a tracking station in Havana in the next year. Sure, there are significant concerns here. And the Iranian-Cuba relationship is very troublesome, and Castro, Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran have formed an alliance in Latin America. It is also troubling. So the question here is not, oh, we should lift the embargo and give away the embargo. The question here is we have to sit down with the Cuban government, and the Cuban government has to offer concession. It's got to pay for the properties that they confiscated from Americans and Cuban Americans 50 years ago that they never paid. They have to liberalize the oppression that they maintain on the Cuban people, and they have to offer other international concessions to the United States to change its policy. We shouldn't give away our policy. If we give away the policy now, what do we have to negotiate if Raul and Fidel die and a future government is willing to offer concessions?
Here's another call from Boston. Isaac is on the line. Isaac, welcome to the program.
I'm a Cuban-American and support the move by Obama recently to make it easier for us to visit our family and to send money. I also agree somewhat with both Jaime and Miriam. The thing that's puzzling to me is why is it so difficult with the Cubans to do what they ask for, which is let's sit down, no preconditions, and let's talk. If the talks don't go well, then people can walk away from the table. But what's the fear of sitting with the Cubans at the table, government to government, and putting all these issues, including human rights, including elections, including a freer marketplace?
May I answer that?
In a minute, Isaac, I'd like to ask you, will you take advantage of these new lifting of restrictions? Do you plan on...
Absolutely.
Yes.
In fact, I'm going with a synagogue tomorrow from Brookline to spend time with the Jewish community. I'm Cuban and Jewish, and we're going to be going with a synagogue from Brookline to spend time with the Jewish community in Cuba, both in Havana and in Cienfuegos.
And do you think it'll make a difference? What difference do you think it will make?
Well, I think it brings people face-to-face to talk about difficult issues. And I agree with Jaime. Nothing happens in the world. I'm a former judge and a lawyer. Nothing happens without both sides giving something up. And the Cubans need to also put some concessions on the table. But what's the fear about sitting and talking face-to-face? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be Obama. He can send an envoy, somebody like Richard Lugar, who's certainly no liberal Democrat, a Republican who said, appoint a special envoy. It doesn't have to be Obama. It doesn't have to be Hillary Clinton. Send an envoy to sit face-to-face. What's the fear?
I hear it. Let's take it to Jaime.
Okay. Isaac, we've been talking to the Cuban government for the past 50 years. We talked in Geneva. We talked in Washington, where there is an intersection. We talked in other countries. We have had agreements with Cuba over hijacking. We have had agreement over migration. There is constant talking right now in the base of Guantanamo Guantanamo base between the Cuban military and the U.S. military. The question is not over talking. The question is over the Cuban willingness to provide concessions to the United States in return for the United States changing its policy. And the history of Cuban-U.S. relations is that the Cubans have not been unwilling to provide meaningful, serious concessions. When they were interested in the immigration accord, they provide concessions. But otherwise, they have not been willing to provide concessions over the fundamental issues that the United States is interested in. Changing Cuba, democracy, human rights, which is the policy of the United States.
So extract concessions first. Miriam Marquez, do you agree?
Well, we've already sort of crossed that and not done it. So I don't know that. I mean, this was an opportunity to try by the Obama administration to have had talks first and then looked at, you know, whether to free it. And they didn't. They did a goodwill gesture. Okay, we're going to forget 50 years of an abysmal human rights record, and everything else that you've done, and exporting revolution all over the place, and say, okay, we're just doing this unilaterally. So what do we get in return now? Family togetherness is great, and that's something that I applaud. I just don't know that we're going to see anything more than that at this point. It all depends on what's really happening inside Cuba. And one thing that I think will be beneficial is as we have more people coming and going, we'll be able to get a better sense of that. I mean, with the once every 3 years travel, which was under the Bush administration, it was difficult unless you, kind of broke the law, which a lot of people did, and went through Cancun or went through one of the islands to get there. Hmm. American tourists, I just don't see. At this point, that's the big carrot dangling out there, and we should hold on to it for a while until we start to see something happening. They still have, 54 of the 75 men and women who were imprisoned in 2003 in sentences that were, on average about 20 years. I mean, what are they going to do about that?
Let's squeeze in another call here before our break. Dean is in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Dean. Welcome to On Point.
I'm concerned about what's going to happen to Cuba when what all this is going to lead to is the collapse of socialism. If we look historically at Cuba, we see a country that was dominated by foreign powers, dominated by the United States, a country that was corrupted and had exploitation of its citizens, to the extent that most of them were poor and illiterate. So I just hope that when the day does come where there is much more freedom in Cuba, that the people do not go back to becoming exploited and the system becomes corrupted again. And I think the potential for that is very great.
Dean, thank you very much for your call. We'll get to more calls after this break. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're discussing Cuba this hour and considering a new future of open travel for Cubans and Cuban Americans. I'm joined by Jaime Szuszlicki, director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami, and by Miriam Marquez, Metro columnist for the Miami Herald newspaper. Let's go back to the phones. First now from Des Moines, Iowa, Suzanne is on the line. Welcome, Suzanne. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Jane. Even though I live in Iowa, I lived in Miami for 5 years, and my children were born there. Ah. Right now, I'm going into economics class at Iowa State, and my observations, I think, I kind of tie into what previous callers were saying. I mean, we're pretty short-sighted if we only look at the history of Cuba. From the time Castro was in power, this is a colonized country by the U.S., and many of the people that initially left Cuba were some of, not all of them, but many of them were the entitled and the oppressors. So if you're looking at this in that broad context, this embargo, I believe, has only assisted Fidel Castro in suppressing the people. Mm. If you look at, most communist governments, trade and economic power will subvert political power in most instances. And it's a silly and ridiculous thing to continue the embargo. Once you open it up, I think a more complex economy will be far more difficult for that government to control.
Suzanne, thank you very much. Jaime, Suzanne feels free markets could have gotten rid of Castro a long time ago.
First of all, I need to answer the two callers that just called. I mean, first of all, if they bothered to look at the United Nations statistics, Cuba was 79% literate, was a modern nation with a large middle class. Sure, it had poverty. Sure, it had casinos. Sure, it had mafia. But so Las Vegas had mafia, and so is Chicago have mafia and corruption. So I think that this perception that Cuba was an oppressed by the upper classes, it's not an accurate perception. Cuba was a vibrant country compared to the rest of Latin America, was ahead of most of Latin America, compared well in terms of health and in terms of education. I invite you, those that just called, to please buy my book. I mean, that'll help my grandchildren and getting a royalty. Buy my book and you'll read about the reasons why there was a revolution in Cuba. It had nothing to do with poverty. It had nothing to do with health. It had to do with political, psychological reasons that were completely different than what the perception of your two speakers.
Ah, thank you. Wallace calling now from South Stratford, Vermont. Wallace, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I did, in the early 2000s, spend quite a bit of time in Cuba working on a cycling guide, of all things, so I got to pedal around the country and see the countryside and get well off the tourist track. Anyway, the reason I'm calling, I have heard many Cuban Americans defending the embargo and travel restrictions, but I haven't heard any protesting, so far at least, the Obama's decision to lift those restrictions or loosen those restrictions with regard to themselves, to Cuban Americans. So I have these two questions. One is, while I can sympathize with the desire of Cuban Americans to maintain ties with their family and to see them, the question is why, in law at least, why should the fact that a U.S. citizen who was born in Cuba be afforded a right, the right to travel to Cuba, that's denied all other U.S. citizens wherever they're born, including born right here in the U.S. And the second one, which is kind of related in a way, has to do with travel. The law that stops us from traveling to Cuba is not a ban on travel per se. It's the Trading with the Enemy Act. Cuba is supposed to be designated as an enemy nation, and so by doing business with them, you're supporting them. Now, the loosening of restrictions will now allow the Cuban-American community here in the States the ability to transfer much more money, literally, probably billions, certainly many millions, to citizens of Cuba, their relatives, their parents, their grandparents, and so on, but still transferring money to citizens of Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I, when I went down there, could be fined, and in fact was fined, for buying a cup of coffee or paying for a hotel room, transferring money to citizens of Cuba. So it's this inconsistency that really bothers me, and I'd love to hear what you guys have to say about it.
Wallace, thank you. Miriam Marquez, will you tackle the second point first?
No, he's right. I mean, there is a special category for people who are family of those left behind, and there's no, I mean, I cannot, you know, I'll let Jaime try to argue that point. But I think the rationale has been for the embargo and why the travel ban exists is back to the confiscation of properties and back to human rights. And so as a human rights initiative, there's a point about families helping families. So that's why the opening occurs. It doesn't fall into place for U.S. tourism. I mean, that's kind of where it is, but it's on shaky ground. I mean, I think it's on shaky ground, but it's the best that we have right now to try to see what the last gasp of this 50-year-old regime will do.
Jaime, your thoughts on the caller's question about trade and
sure.
also travel.
Well, consistency has never been a characteristic of any foreign policy of any country. Every foreign policy of every country is somewhat inconsistent and somewhat contradictory. If the argument is, sure, the Americans should be able to travel any place they want, I agree. There's no question to that argument. The issue here is that once the U.S. has embarked on this policy, you just don't give it away. You trade it. And by the way, the prohibition for travel for Americans to Cuba has been tested. It went all the way to the Supreme Court in 1988, and the Supreme Court agreed that it's the right of the American government to withhold the travel of any American to any country that they feel is necessary for the national interest, for security, or for other reasons. So while I agree with you that Americans should be able to travel, I think the travel ban, as well as other parts of the policy, should be negotiated, not given away. And when there is a regime in Cuba willing to negotiate, we'll do it. If it's not the Castro brothers, it'll be the next regime.
Here's another call now from Detroit, Michigan. Charles is on the line. Charles, welcome.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
I personally think that it's a very, very good effort on President Obama's part to lift the embargo, because when you think about it, I mean, whether you're from Cuba, America, France, England, wherever you're from, you know, it's a human issue that we're dealing with, and there's no sense in fighting back and forth over spilled milk. In these days and times, we need to just get ourselves together, import, export, whatever we're doing, regardless of what country we live in, and try to get along as much as we can as possible, because we're living in times now where the hand is on another number, and it don't make sense for us to be uncivilized in any form or fashion. Cuba has problems. America has problems. We all have problems when it comes to education, when it comes to our medical facilities and things of that nature. We need to look at our elders. We need to look at our young people. And we just need to look at life for what it really is instead of arguing and bickering over spilt milk.
Charles, thank you.
They're so immature.
Thank you very much. To clarify, lifting the embargo has not happened. These Obama rules on travel and remittances, which have changed, which the lifting of the restrictions is actually what we're talking about this hour. I want to go to another call now for Maria, who's in Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Maria. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jen.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, what I think is that you guys are not really looking at the big picture. Castro has been gone so many presidents of the United States, and he's still very much alive. And instead, he is transforming the entire continent. Countries like Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador have turned like Cuba. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think President Obama is doing right doing that. Changing the policies with Cuba will change the entire continent, and the governments that are turning like Cuba now.
That's a good point, Maria. Thank you for bringing it up. Jaime, would you respond to that, the impact of Fidel Castro's Cuba on the entire region?
Well, Fidel Castro has been a troublesome issue in American foreign policy since the time that he introduced Russian or Soviet missiles in Cuba and brought the world to the brink of extinction. He has supported terrorist groups in the Middle East. He has been the founder of the PLO. Together with Arafat, he's provided money and refuge to Hamas, to the ELN from Colombia, to a number of terrorist groups. He has been an enemy of the United States for the past 50 years. The Cuban embassies throughout the world are devoted 24 hours a day to attacking and undermining American foreign policies. So, look, sure, you can be nice to a dictator like this that has been an enemy of the United States, give him the embargo, give him travel ban, but I don't think that that is healthy. What is healthy is to negotiate, not to give away a policy to an enemy of the United States for 50 years.
You know, there's one aspect of this story that we haven't talked about yet, and that is the racial component here. The majority of people who emigrate from Cuba are white, and those that are left behind, for the most part, are black and mixed race.
Correct.
Any way to balance that? What's the answer to that problem, Jaime?
Well, let me just make a point. The money that is being sent by relatives to Cuba goes mostly to white families in the island. There are very few blacks in the United States. So the 68% that are mulatto and black in Cuba are not going to benefit from this remittances, as they don't benefit from tourism. The tourist resorts are controlled primarily by white members of the security apparatus. They're the ones, the travel agencies, the buses are all controlled by Cuban whites, not by Cuban blacks. And the Cuban government, the higher you go in the Cuban government, the more whites and less blacks. The Politburo of the Cuban Communist Party is primarily white. The Cuban armed forces, the generals are almost all white. So Cuba is a segregated society where the blacks are not benefiting from the revolution's benefits.
Back to the phones for more calls now. Jan is from Grundy Center, Iowa. Welcome, Jan. Thank you for waiting.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to introduce some other variables to the discussion here. I don't know a lot about Cuba. I realize it's a very complex issue, and there are no easy fixes, but I'm very supportive of us beginning to have dialogue. I think it's a really negative paradigm if we begin to talk about people, especially groups of people that are such close neighbors as enemies. I think that that's language that we need to really move away from, and we need to really begin to dialogue. I wanted just to talk a minute about the fact that there's been a great deal of change in Cuba from what I know, especially since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that decisions that were made by our government have further isolated them, and I think that from data that I've looked at, they actually have a very high literacy rate, and I know that they export many, many doctors from that area, but the country went through drastic change, and I think as far as green issues and economic issues, they've made some real strong headways in terms of organic farming and feeding the population, and despite the fact that they're very poor, they have a equal or better infant mortality rate, and that they probably have more literate and educated people than our country does. So just was interested in your comments on that.
Jan, thanks. Miriam Marquez?
There is definitely literacy is high, and if we're to trust the statistics that come out of the Cuban government, and I hate to sound like, you know, some crazy Cuban conspiracy theorist, but if we're to trust those numbers, yes, the death rate and everything else is better than in most Latin American countries. What we don't have is we have a separate and unequal health system in Cuba. People come from out of the country to Cuba for certain surgeries, and they get the state of the art facilities. The party officials get the state of the art facilities, and everybody else is struggling. And I know that from personal experience. I had an aunt who died in Cuba in a hospital that was just abysmal. That there's not anything like it anywhere in this country. And of course, you know, they'll argue that, well, they're third world. That's true, but that this was the crown jewel of the revolution. Cubans are consistently complaining about the fact that they have no medicines and that their doctors are all being exported to Latin America, the islands, and all parts of Africa, that their doctors are not there for them. And that's true as well. And it's part of – and the reason Cuba does it is it makes money for them. They send their doctors to other countries. They get – money in exchange for their help, and the doctors are paid just a small amount to get out, and a lot of them have essentially left, and it's one route for them to try to leave the country and get to the U.S. or to Spain or to other parts.
And so, Jaime, might opening dialogue help change those kinds of conditions?
Well, first of all, I think we have to emphasize that the reasons that there are no medicines and hospitals in Cuba have nothing to do with the embargo. The Cubans are allowed to buy medicine, and they buy food in the United States to the tune of about $700 million per year. The point here is that the embargo is not the cause of Cuba's economic suffering. The reason the Cubans are suffering is because of a political and economic system that is not productive, that doesn't work like it didn't work in Eastern Europe, like it didn't work in the Soviet Union. The fact that there are no mangoes and no bananas and no potatoes in Cuba have nothing to do with the embargo. It has to do with a failed agricultural policy that is collectivized, that is controlled by the state. There's no private initiative. So that doesn't work. It got nothing to do with the embargo.
And so how do you see in our last 30 seconds here these new easing of restrictions by President Obama? How do you see that changing things in Cuba on the ground in the next year or two or 5 years?
Well,
I mean?
initially the Cubans will receive $200 or $300 million more in remittances and more visits and so on. The question now is whether the Cuban government is willing to reciprocate the offering of Obama and begin to change its system. I doubt it. So I think we're going to be locked in a very difficult situation between the United States and Cuba. Cuba is unwilling to provide concessions to the U.S. because they have Venezuela, they have China, they have Iran. They don't need the United States, and although they would like a unilateral lifting of the embargo, they are not willing to open up Cuba.
Many thanks to my guests this hour, Jaime Szuszlicki, director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami, author of From Columbus to Castro and Beyond. Thank you very much, Jaime.
Thank you.
And Miriam Marquez, Metro columnist for the Miami Herald newspaper, among other things. Thank you, Miriam.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.